Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. A relatively new UN doctrine known as Responsibility to Protect got its first road test 1 year ago in Libya. Last March, NATO forces began bombing the country to prevent mass civilian deaths at the hands of the Gaddafi regime. It was the first military action taken under this principle, often called by its shorthand, R2P. It's the idea that international institutions cannot stand idly by while governments commit so-called crimes against humanity against their own populations. The UN officially adopted R2P as a guiding principle in 2005, pushed in part by guilt over the Rwandan and Bosnian genocides in the 1990s. But putting this principle into practice is controversial. While some called R2P's debut in Libya a major success, critics fear this doctrine will be misinterpreted and misused, an excuse for more foreign intervention in domestic conflicts, and an invitation for Western powers to reshape the world to their liking. Then there's the sticky question of when you use it and when you don't. For example, why invoke it to protect the people of Libya, but not for the equally beleaguered people of Syria? Today in The Exchange, Responsibility to Protect, how it came about, why it's sometimes controversial, and let's hear from you. Do world organizations like the UN have a responsibility to protect civilians in other nations or not? Could this new doctrine lead to a more peaceful, safer world, or does R2P create more space for foreign intervention and war? Give us a call. The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email at exchange@nhpr.org or send us your thoughts on our Facebook page. Our guests are Bill Martell, Associate Professor of International Security Studies at Tufts University's Fletcher School, also author of the book Victory in War, Foundations of Modern Strategy. And Bill, it's great to see you. Thank you for being here.
Thank you, Laura, so much. Thank you.
Also with us, Michael Contarino, Politics and Society Program Director at UNH Manchester. He's also published several articles about responsibility to protect. And Michael, it's good to see you too. Thank you for being
here.
Nice
to be here. Thank you.
Well, Bill, I'll start with you. Just how big a departure is this from standard thinking about the role of international institutions, the sovereign rights of nations, and so forth?
It's a huge departure. And what I suggest to people is go back and look at the structure of the Cold War. And really, it's the end of the Cold War that has established, and everybody will now, at the end of the show, they're all going to be R2P experts. They're going to know this is going to roll off their tongues. During the Cold War, we had a bipolar system. It was divided into two camps, Moscow and Washington. And Each side had very well-established spheres of interest. It had spheres of influence. It had clients. And so either side didn't casually go and intervene in the affairs of the others. With the end of the Cold War and with a series of events that I'm sure Mike will talk about and we'll all talk about, there's been a series of humanitarian disasters, genocide, wars, famines and the like, which have caused the international community to say, on the one hand, there are a series of cases where we feel an obligation to intervene. If we watch, for example, a famine in Somalia, we just can't stand back and watch. On the other hand, when we begin to intervene in these kinds of crises, we are beginning to violate some very fundamental terms or rules in international politics, sovereignty being the big one, and we'll get to that in a second. So what we now have is this shift in international politics from this is verboten, we don't get involved in these kinds of things, to where we do increasingly, and the list of places where we've intervened, invoking either directly or indirectly this right to protect R2P, is increasing, and it's become part of the coin of the realm in international politics in modern times.
Now, something you said actually is part of what makes this controversial. It's officially called responsibility to protect.
Yes, yeah.
Some people, though, are feeling like it's a right to protect.
Well, they do. And in fact, the argument that people have is that if I, as the United States or France or Germany or Britain or China or other or Russia, watch a humanitarian crisis unfolding, do we have a responsibility to intervene? Do we have a right to intervene? If we have a right to intervene, am I then violating, as that intervening force, the sovereignty, the independent political rights of independence of that particular society? So it's been a very messy kind of issue, but it is gaining, if you will, momentum in international politics at a time when we're now a generation, we're 20 years out from the end of the Cold War, and now it's becoming much more part of the ordinary discourse in international politics.
Well, and there's a history here too, right, Michael? I mean, this doctrine was adopted back in 2005, as I said. What were the feelings, the past events that motivated this change?
Well, this takes place in a historical context, obviously. The process whereby the international community has started to take responsibility for dealing in some way with atrocity crimes, genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, ethnic cleansing. The first big step forward took place after the Holocaust when the Nazis killed 6 million people in the worst act of genocide in history. In 1948, we saw the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and we saw the Genocide Convention, whereby the international community said, never again. Unfortunately, as Bill was suggesting before, we have seen horrendous acts of genocide and ethnic cleansing since then, not just in Rwanda, not just in Cambodia, but in Europe itself, in the former Yugoslavia. The international community has had to wrestle with, well, how can we really mean it when we say never again? And the responsibility to protect was a very important step forward in that process, because the international community was saying this is not just a right to intervene. It's a responsibility of individual governments to prevent these crimes within their own borders. And if you read the language of the outcome document of the General Assembly of 2005, which establishes this principle, the emphasis is very strongly not upon international intervention, but rather upon the responsibility of individual governments to prevent these crimes within their own borders.
So external and internal responsibility.
International intervention only takes place when governments have manifestly failed, and the emphasis again is upon assisting governments in preventing these crimes through diplomacy, through technical assistance, and so on and so forth. And only as a very last resort should coercive measures be taken by the international community, and even then only with a UN Security Council authorization.
It's pretty subjective, though, Michael, isn't it? I mean, you know, you may externally say, gosh, country ABC is really, you know, committing atrocities against its people. The rulers of country ABC may say, these folks are troublemakers and we're dealing with them ourselves. Thank you very much.
Usually it's not that subjective. Usually when people are being slaughtered by their governments or by rebel groups within a country, it's pretty obvious that human rights violations are taking place, and the international community has mechanisms to assess the gravity of these. The International Criminal Court, for example, can undertake preliminary investigations to determine whether or not certain crimes are taking place and a prosecution should be begun.
So it's not so subjective, you know, one person's interpretation versus another's. There are factual rubrics to say, yes, this is a crime against humanity.
These crimes are defined. Certainly, usually people who are committing them are denying them. Bill, you might want to add something.
I would agree with Mike. I would probably just make a slight caveat, is that there's a general consensus when we watch something terrible going on in the international community. What is always lacking is something, I'm searching for words, but empirical, systematic, scientific, verifiable that in fact this is violating those rules of international politics. We all pretty much agree. It goes back to, was it Justice Potter on pornography? We all recognize and we see it. So everybody recognizes when there's a crisis going on, but it never has that absolute scientific mathematical precision that says absolutely this is the case and nobody can disagree with that, even though we all pretty much agree that this is a problem that we have to deal with. The other side of the coin that I would throw in here is that, and one of the hesitations to get involved in right or responsibility to protect, and if it's a responsibility, maybe it becomes a right, we'll see what happens, is states have worried and policymakers and societies have worried that in fact what we might see is a world in which there's just a never-ending series of obligations to which we have to respond.
The world's policeman.
Yeah, the world's policeman. And, you know, there's not great support in American society for that. There's not much support in the international community for this. I look at numbers, for example, on Afghanistan. I mean, 2/3, 3/4 of the American people want to be out. So that has been part of the delaying mechanism, or part of the hesitation to get involved in these kinds of crises. We can go back, I'm sure, during the show and talk about things like Bosnia, for example, or Somalia, and that was very much part of the debate. You know, what are the limits? Draw some lines for me in the sand that, yes, I'll intervene here, but no, I won't here. How do I calibrate that?
Okay, and since you said let's draw a line, yes here, no here, let's deal with the elephant in the room, gentlemen. And Michael, we intervened in Libya to protect those people, but we're not intervening in Syria to protect those people. 8,000 dead, according to the UN's latest count.
Yeah, I think that what we are seeing here is a major challenge to the doctrine of responsibility to protect. Last year, when the intervention took place in Libya, the Security Council did its job. It recognized that an atrocious situation was taking place. It stepped in several ways. It authorized no-fly zone and military intervention, which did prevent a bloodbath that looked like it was about to take place. It also authorized the International Criminal Court to undertake an investigation, and within days, arrest warrants were issued by the International Criminal Court for Gaddafi and two other people.
So it was by the book.
So it worked in that case. It's now not working in Syria, where we have atrocities being committed by the Syrian government every day, and the Security Council is blocked. Russia and China vetoed action, and therefore the Security Council is simply not doing what the Security Council is supposed to do. And I think this is a real challenge to the doctrine, but I also think it's a challenge to the Security Council. If the Security Council proves to be unable or unwilling to do what it's supposed to do in a situation such as Syria, then this will possibly bring into play the need to discover other mechanisms whereby the international community can determine that action is necessary.
Well, and we'll talk about this, why not Syria if we did Libya. But real quickly, Bill Martell, a little United Nations 101, remind us about the Security Council that we keep talking about.
I'm smiling, Laura, because we're easing all of your listenership into the arcana of the UN Security Council. The UN Security Council is a General Assembly, which every country has a seat. Then we have what is called the Security Council. On the Security Council, we have what are called the P5 or the Perm 5. Permanent 5 members have veto. Over anything, that any Security Council resolution. So if the Americans, the British, the French say, absolutely, we want to support intervention in Syria, but the Russians and Chinese veto it, it just stops. It dies.
Well, a lot more to talk about, gentlemen, after a short break. And we'll start taking your calls to 1-800-892-6477. Stay with us.
Good morning, it's 9:19, and support for NHPR comes from UR members. Support also comes to us from Restaurant Week Portsmouth and the Seacoast, a 10-day culinary experience featuring 42 restaurants today through March 31st. Details at restaurantweekportsmouth.com. And from the Currier Museum of Art in Manchester, presenting a new vision, Modernist Photography, featuring striking images from the 1920s to the present. Details at courier.org. More on the UN doctrine, known as responsibility to protect, on The Exchange on NHPR, then at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. It's the Friday News Roundup. New Hampshire weather today, partly to mostly sunny, not as warm as it has been. Highs near 60 in the North Country, ranging to 70 in southern areas of the state. Partly cloudy tonight, lows near 30 north, ranging to 40 in the south. Tomorrow, partly sunny for northern areas of the state, clouding up in the rest of the state. Highs from 50 north, ranging to 60 in the south. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the new UN doctrine known as responsibility to protect. We've been discussing its origins and how it's been applied recently in Libya, and questions now about whether it should be applied in Syria. We invite you to join us at 1-800-892-6477 or send us a short email. exchange@nhpr.org is the address. Also, The Exchange is now on Facebook, so we hope you go to our page and join the conversation there. Our number again is 1-800-892-6477. And before we go to our listeners, Bill Martell, I did want to get your thoughts as well about, you know, a lot of people are saying, hey, we did this responsibility to protect in Libya. We went in there, we protected those people against what could have been mass killings at the hands of Gaddafi. We're not doing that in Syria, and some people are okay with that, but others are uncomfortable.
It goes right back to the question that you asked just before the break, Laura, which is the UN Security Council. And if any one of the five permanent members of the UN Security Council says no, then the UN Security Council cannot proceed with an intervention sanctioned by the Council. And the Russians, principally, with the Chinese, have vetoed any effort on the part of getting involved in Syria. Question becomes why. Syria is a very close ally of Russia. It depends upon Russia for military terms. And Russia is playing a balance of power game in the Middle East, using its influence with Syria as a way to counterbalance American influence in other parts of the Middle East. So what we have, in essence, is the classic problem that all of your listeners have thought about, I suspect, over time, which is the UN can be very effective, very well-intentioned, very well-meaning. But if we have great power disputes that manifest or express themselves in the Security Council, intervention just comes to a grinding halt, and there is no that's the court of last appeal.
Fine. Well, and Michael did a great job describing how in Libya it really was by the book, just as any supporter of responsibility to protect would want to see it happen. But so what do you do, Bill? I mean, in this case of Syria, what do you say to those people who, you know, are being killed? Sorry?
Well, actually, what's interesting is in the last several days, Russia has changed. Russia is now moving in support of a UN Security Council resolution against Syria. I suspect in part because the Russians and the Chinese have both switched their votes, and they're both beginning, I think, over the last month or two or three, they don't like being beaten up over the question of why are you supporting an authoritarian regime in Syria, which is slaughtered by your account, Laura, the number you cite of 8,000 people
from the
have died.
United Nations.
Yeah,
Michael.
Yeah, I think it's important to realize that the mechanism that was established by the outcome document in 2005 was that the Security Council didn't have just a right to intervene when it wants, but a responsibility to intervene when it's required. And the Security Council, if it doesn't do that, comes under pressure as an institution, and the recalcitrant members, in this case Russia and China, come under a lot of political pressure from the United States, from France and Britain, and from others. As a result of this, they're starting to potentially soften, because they realize that the risk is that they delegitimize the Council itself as a mechanism for enforcing the responsibility to protect. People are going to start talking about other ways of authorizing interventions, such as, for example, using the General Assembly to provide a legitimation of intervention. That's the last thing in the world that any permanent member of the Security Council wants to see, including the United States, France, and Britain, because they have a very privileged role in the Council. They want to keep it that way. But I think the responsibility to protect as an international norm has been has sufficient strength at this point that if the Security Council manifestly and repeatedly fails to apply it, people will start to talk very seriously about finding alternative mechanisms.
Our phone number again on the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. Join us as we look at this doctrine called responsibility to protect and tell us what you think. Do international organizations like the UN have a responsibility to protect civilians in other nations or not? Is it ever appropriate to intervene or not? Could this doctrine lead to a more peaceful world, or does it provide an excuse for foreign intervention and for war? Tell us what you think. The exchange number 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. And first up from Bo is Katrina. Hi, Katrina. Thanks for joining us. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. And I want to congratulate you on such an important topic. Several times during the discussion so far this morning, you referred to this responsibility to protect doctrine as a somewhat new notion, and I just wanted to offer a little historical context. I actually teach a course that deals with this at Tufts University, so greetings to you, Professor Martel.
Hi, Katrina.
Hi. But its roots, even its formulated roots, go back quite a ways to the 1600s, to a Dutch jurist by the name of Hugo Grotius, who was the first to sort of formalize this older notion of humanitarian intervention in the case of a supreme humanitarian crisis or emergency. And so, you know, this notion, this doctrine has very, very deep roots, and you know, I certainly agree with your guess that some of the recent, you know, just tragic atrocities on a massive scale prompted, you know, and the failure of the world community, despite the existence of a United Nations, despite the Universal Declaration, the failure of the world community to act, sort of led to and provided the impetus for a more current formulation of this doctrine. But it has very, very significant historical roots. And I think it's also worthwhile to remember that it has limiting principles. You know, there are various criteria that need to be met. You know, it is used as a last resort. There has to be proportional means. Other options have to sort of have been exhausted first.
And you can't just go around intervening wherever you want, Katrina.
Yeah, it's certainly, you know, both in practice and maybe too much so in practice, but also I think in formulation, it's not simply a carte blanche to say, oh, you know, we are dismayed by what's going on here. You know, here we go.
So, Katrina, a vote from you for responsibility to protect.
Absolutely, absolutely. And the emerging sort of companion doctrine, which is sometimes called W2I, the will to intervene, you know, because it's one thing to declare a responsibility to protect, but as we see, certainly in the case of Syria, sometimes the will to act on that responsibility is absent. And so, you know, that's sort of another acronym that's beginning to emerge, which is trying to look at, you know, how do nations summon in the face of opposition? Because it's always going to be controversial. I mean, there are so many arguments for and against. It is almost equally controversial when it takes place and when it doesn't take place. You know, we have Rwanda, which is a stain on, you know, the conscience of the world, and Syria, which is becoming a stain on the conscience of the world, but it's pretty controversial when it happens.
Right. Well, Katrina, thank you so much for joining us, especially given your background in this issue. Michael, do you want to jump in?
Yeah, Katrina's absolutely right in putting this in a long-term historical context. And I think that's the best way to look at R2P. I don't think we should look at it as the world is now going to successfully stop atrocity crimes everywhere they occur. That's not a realistic expectation. I think what we're looking at is a long-term process that indeed did begin centuries ago, in which the idea that atrocities will be tolerated becomes delegitimized and becomes normal for people around the world to see, to take responsibility to prevent them from occurring. I see this the way one might look at, say, slavery or colonialism, which used to be legitimate forms of international behavior. Today, we look on those things as unacceptable, and any government that were to legalize slavery would be seen as a rogue, and would not be able to accomplish that. And I think that very short period of time ago, colonialism was considered normal. It is no longer normal. I think R2P is an important step in a long-term process whereby we normalize the idea that governments have a responsibility to protect their citizens from atrocity crimes, whether they're taking place within their own borders or elsewhere.
So 50 years, 60, 70 years from now, Michael, we might think responsibility to protect is, well, of course.
Well, like Yogi Berra, I never make predictions, especially about the future. but I think there's an arc of time whereby a norm becomes a norm. And I think R2P is a very important step in the wake of other important steps and additional such as the creation of the International Criminal Court and the earlier Genocide Convention. And I think there will be additional steps as the world tries to grapple with, well, how do we deal with this problem effectively? We've committed ourselves to doing so. Now, how do we do so?
Well, I want to ask you about that too, Bill, but also remind our listeners that you can join us. Katrina, thank you for that call. Our number here in the exchange, 1-800-892-6477. What are your thoughts on this relatively new UN doctrine called responsibility to protect? Our number, 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange at nhpr.org. Also, we're now on Facebook, so you can go to our page and join the conversation there. You know, Bill, Katrina hit on a criticism of responsibility to protect, even though she didn't agree with it. But the concern is that this doctrine creates a good cover, a good excuse for nations to intervene, and that mm-hmm. it might actually escalate violence around the world. What do you think?
Well, I was listening to Katrina's comments. I thought they were right on. What occurred to me as listening to Katrina was the question of Somalia. And the reason I mentioned Somalia is it both helped coalesce an international consensus that there are terrible things going on out there in the contemporary sense that we need to deal with. But Somalia is also interesting because that's when the international community intervenes, provides support, engages in whatever choose our verb in that particular crisis or humanitarian problem, there can be opposition to it. And the reason Somalia is interesting is because we went in the international community with the U.S., UN, and lots of what are called NGOs and IGOs, intergovernmental organizations and non-governmental organizations, came in to help.
Give us some examples, if you could, of those groups.
Sure.
Familiar names.
Intergovernmental organizations, UN, World Trade Organization, those are all classic examples. Non-governmental organizations, International Red Cross. Red Cross, by the way, just a footnote to this, provided the vast majority of assistance in the U.S. in Hurricane Katrina in food and shelter. Not governmental organizations, not FEMA. The problem with that Somalia indicates is sometimes the international community gets involved in intervening. It can generate military opposition by the country in which we're intervening. Somalia is such a classic case because the warlords under Idid and others began actively fighting against both U.S. and U.N. forces, and everybody remembers Black Hawk Down. So the downside or the price that we potentially pay as an international community and as a society is that when we intervene, and that's not a code word for military force, but we become involved, there can be opposition that can lead to combatant operations. And I think that's something that we need to keep in mind. I'm not saying we don't intervene, but it is a price that we do potentially pay when we get involved in these crises.
Well, one analysis I came across picked up on what you just said, Bill, that for the perpetrators of violence, the prospect of foreign intervention, possible prosecution, rules out the possibility for compromise. For any rebels that are operating, it creates a perverse incentive to escalate violence so as to provoke an international military response. What do you think, Michael, that the use of this doctrine, responsibility to protect, can have the potential to inflame violence and tensions within a country?
It can, and that's why it has to be done very carefully. This is what's sometimes called the peace versus justice debate, when you back a violent person into a corner, you should probably not expect anything other than violence. And so it's important to manage these situations carefully. In the application of the principle of R2P, obviously governments have to consider very carefully what are the prospects for success, what tactics might work, what tactics might not work. Is this a situation which we would be better off not intervening at all because we can't succeed? And there will be situations like that. There's not going to be universal and successful application of the principle. That would not be a realistic expectation.
Really? Now say that again, because that's an important point.
Yeah. I mean, we live in the real world. There will be situations where the costs of intervention will exceed the benefits and won't happen. Imagine a situation, for example, if a large and powerful country, I won't mention any countries like China, were to engage in human rights violations in Tibet, say. The international community is not going to be able to intervene except diplomatically in other ways that are quite possibly not going to succeed. We don't, just because we can't always succeed in stopping murder or rape doesn't mean we don't illegalize these things and try to stop them when we can.
Well, what you're saying relates to an email that I've got here from Lena in Boston, who says, I believe that several countries are taking at least some R2P actions in Syria, e.g. in the form of sanctions. The European Union just this morning blacklisted the members of the family of the Syrian leader in addition to himself. She says, isn't this what R2P is intended to cover? They have not yet taken the action of the last resort, action of resorting to force, but at least they have started, even if it is not through the UN. And Lena says, can your commentators comment on this? Lena, thank you so much. What do you think about this, Bill? You know, it isn't all about just going in there with, you know, bombs and tanks.
No, and it isn't. And it can range from using military force, which is the extreme example, and it's often not that. It's usually providing pretty mundane kinds of things, food, water, peacekeeping forces, all designed to separate the opposing forces if they exist, or to provide food, water, and other supplies to a population that may be suffering from a famine. Somalia, again, is the perfect case. But the other side of this, so Lena makes a very good point. The other side of this is that that societies and the international community, and Mike was making this point, I think, quite nicely, the code word for are the costs and benefits of intervention proportionate and are they worth it from our point of view is this a vital interest of the country to get involved? In Somalia, in Haiti, in Rwanda, in Bosnia, Kosovo, many argued, yes, it's an appalling set of circumstances, but is there a vital American or other interest that compels us to get involved, particularly when you may put American kids' lives on the line if they're out there on the pointed edge of the spear actually using military force to separate opposing groups. That's where the debate has really fallen apart. We went through this debate in the United States in the 1990s during the Clinton administration over Bosnia. For years we were debating, should we get involved? And I can vividly remember General Colin Powell saying, sure, if we're going to, and Senator McCain was part of this debate as well, if we're going to get involved, are Americans willing to put 250,000 forces, ground forces, in Bosnia to intervene? That's what's required to prevent this, to stop this genocide. And that had powerful, that resonated powerfully in American society after we had watched Black Hawk Down in Somalia. So it, I think what we're seeing, and a good example today, an interesting example, is Haiti with the earthquakes last year. That's a no. There was no public discussion at all other than how do we help, and whatever help we can provide is essential. But there's other categories out there of crises that, that require assistance where you can have military operations being conducted by American or UN forces against opposing groups in those societies.
So what are you saying, Bill? Are you saying that responsibility to protect should only apply in cases where the United States has a strategic interest?
No, I'm saying that the uncertainties about whether about the costs of getting involved tend to express themselves as hesitation about whether to actually participate. Though there is an emerging consensus that, in fact, it's a good idea for the international community, including the Americans, to provide assistance. But it's not absolute because people start asking, particularly if there's opposition. If we go into Syria, for example, today, which I think I would support, particularly arming the rebels to fight against the Syrian government.
Kind of what we did in Libya.
Exactly what we did in Libya. But the very clear limits that were drawn by the Obama administration and by the Congress and really by society here in the States was we'll provide assistance. Nobody was jumping up and lining up to start putting in combatant forces into Libya to stop that civil war. That seems to me that probably that bright red line between providing lots of assistance and throwing military forces to intervene in these crises.
Well, lots of tough stuff to figure out. And Michael, I'll get your thoughts after a short break, too. Our number here in the exchange is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR. Lena, thanks for that email. The email address is exchange@nhpr.org. Again, exchange@nhpr.org. And you can also join us on Facebook. We'll be right back.
NHPR's March membership drive was a success. With the help of more than 4,500 listeners over the last 2 weeks, we've raised $450,000. In the coming weeks and months, we'll use that money to pay for
office supplies,
our Shifting the Balance series,
election coverage for later this year,
electricity bills,
special events like Ira Flato in Durham.
Thank you to all our members who helped to make this possible.
Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from Southern New Hampshire Medical Center and Foundation Medical Partners, working together to design healthcare around you, where you live and work, snhmc.org. And from Interglass Window Systems, creator of The Perfect Storm, helping you preserve your historic windows, exhibiting at this weekend's Old House and Barn Expo in Manchester. Good morning, it's 9:40. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Monday in The Exchange, abortion has made national headlines as more states attempt to toughen abortion laws, including here in New Hampshire. We'll find out more. Email us your thoughts before the program at exchange@nhpr.org and join us Monday morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, the debate over the UN's so-called responsibility to protect doctrine. We've been talking about this. Join us with your thoughts, 1-800-892-6477, or email exchange@nhpr.org. Our guests are Michael Contarino, Politics and Society Program Director at UNH Manchester, and Bill Martell. He's at Tufts University's Fletcher School of Diplomacy. And gentlemen, let's go right back to our callers, and Brian's calling in from Nashua. Hi, Brian. You're on the air. Go ahead. And I hope Brian calls back. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. You know, Michael, just picking up on what Bill said before the break, we have this idealistic feeling that, you know, responsibility to protect, and everyone hates to see, you know, genocide. I mean, no one wants to see that happening somewhere else. And yet we have strategic interests. How do we mesh the two of those? You know, is it really worth intervening when we have no hard-nosed, cold strategic interest in a certain country?
Yeah, that's obviously a very important and very difficult question. I guess it depends on how we define national interests. If we define them in traditional terms, then nations obviously are rarely going to be champing at the bit to intervene in coercive ways or ways that might be very costly in order for humanitarian purposes in other countries. On the other hand, the international community has embraced the principle that these things do matter, and to the extent that such, when we say never again, we mean it. Nations, public opinion in the intervening nations becomes increasingly favorable to these interventions. So, you know, what is in the national interest is a subjective concept. It's not an objective one.
So it may not be, you know, oil is often cited,
right,
or
right.
Strategic interests. But you're saying there's a broader interest in being a good citizen of the world.
Well, we're living in a historical period when the world is getting smaller and smaller. Communication is getting better and better. Our interdependencies are more and more evident to everybody. People tend to be more aware of what's going on in other countries than they used to, and they can see some of the implications of what goes on there for them. And as a consequence of that, think of the Kony video that just came out a couple of weeks ago. Not that that is particularly substantive, I don't think, but it's indicative of the fact that public opinion can really change very fast in an age of the internet. And
remind us what that is. That has to do with Uganda,
yeah.
And it's kind of gone all over the place, and it shows just horrible things happening to children.
And we suddenly had a lot of ordinary people who ordinarily would not have known about this or cared about this being upset about war crimes taking place.
Yeah, and that's interesting. And that's a quick question I wanted to ask you, Bill, before we go back to our listeners. How has the advent of social media and just what Michael said, you know, even if no traditional reporter can get into a country where there's trouble, the citizens there can open up their cell phones and take pictures of stuff happening. And this Kony video absolutely has caused a huge outcry. How has that whole speeded up instant information, pictures from anywhere, contributed to this desire for a responsibility to protect? It's kind of created a movement for this ethic.
I could count on most of the fingers of my right hand at 4 to 5 cases where social media was the principal motivating force behind political revolutions in societies. Tunisia, Morocco, Egypt, Syria arguably, Libya arguably. I guess I'm moving to my left hand now. I can argue, but other regimes in the Middle East. So this social media is now changing it. Somebody in Syria could be listening to the show right now, Laura. I mean, that's how globalized we have become. So I think that's a strategic change that the policy community, society, the media is beginning to be aware of, but no one's thinking about it very systematically. In the States, in fact, we now have social media events that have criminal activities associated with mobs that emerge instantaneously in a store. So this has both positive and negatives, but it is a very powerful force now.
Let's take another call. This is George in Eppingham. Hi, George. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm just calling. I'd like to kind of respectfully disagree with the guests on a premise they made in the very beginning that these crimes are all subjective and that the motives of people or that they're objective. I would argue that they're subjective and that there are a lot of double standards, and that's why these projects don't work. I was actually in southern Sudan while the whole Libya thing was unfolding, and I can say that the Sudanese looked at it from a totally different perspective than Americans. And you know, when you look at Libya, and as far as protecting nationals in Libya, we're not in Libya anymore. We got rid of Gaddafi. There's still summer executions and things going on in Libya, and we're not there. We left. Once Gaddafi was removed, we left. And I think the Chinese and the Russians saw that, and it wasn't just that we were there to protect civilians. We basically got rid of Gaddafi and left. And so they're a little skeptical with Syria. I mean, I don't necessarily agree with them, but they're also looking at it, well, you know, the Russians, the Chinese, and other people in the world are saying this is just another excuse for the United States and NATO to remove a regime that they don't like. And once the regime is moved, we'll move on to the next.
You know, this is real interesting, and those were some of the points I was trying to get at earlier. So I'm glad you called, George. Tell me, though, so you were in southern Sudan and during the time when the intervention was going on in Libya. What did people there say about U.N. intervention, NATO intervention in that area of the world, in southern Sudan?
Well, I think they were a little cynical. I mean, for the most part, I was with people from South Sudan who had just been liberated from northern Sudan, and I was still with people who were northern Sudanese.
Mm-hmm.
And they all agreed on one thing. This was just a blatant, from their perspective, it was a blatant regime change. It was a power grab. And the argument wasn't about the power grab. The argument, the fact that it was one, but in their discussions, it was, is it justified? Is it a good thing? Is it good for the Middle East? Is it good for Libya? Is it good for Sudan? But there was nothing about kind of protecting, you know, and this is even from people who were victims of this type of action. They didn't, you know, they kind of looked at it, and it was, to them, it was all, you know, just a matter of politics and a matter of, you know, is it good to remove Gaddafi or not? And they had disagreements on that, but they weren't under any, you know, illusion that it was there to protect the citizens of Libya. And to a certain degree, you know, you look at it now, there are all kinds of things going on in Libya. People are being killed, and we're not there. We're not protecting those civilians anymore.
Okay.
We got rid of
George,
Gaddafi.
This is great, and thank you very much for calling in. And, you know, gentlemen, it's one thing to say responsibility to protect, and, you know, at the UN sitting in those nice offices, it sounds great, but Michael, some cynicism that, you know, that the motives here are pure.
That cynicism is entirely warranted. Motives are rarely pure, and there are going to be situations that are ambiguous. However, there are definitions of what constitute genocide and war crimes and crimes against humanity, and there are at least rudimentary institutions now at the international level to determine when these things are actually occurring. The International Criminal Court, again, being a very important instrument that my colleagues, Melinda Negrin-Gonzalez, Kevin Mason, and I have written on this recently, that we believe that over time the International Criminal Court will be able to help define and determine when violations are taking place and apply them in a judicial context. But yeah, there are going to be situations of ambiguity. That's why we have courts, and that's why we have laws at the domestic level, and we need to have procedures at the international level too to determine when this occurs.
I would say too, to George, it's really good comments. I thought we were pretty much in agreement that we all recognize it, but there aren't objective, precise criteria. There's a subjective quality to this, and that's just human affairs. I mean, everything we do is interpreted through lenses that we all carry and shape.
So what crimes against humanity really are?
And
whether they're taking place.
Yeah, whether they're taking place, the extent to which they're taking place, whether they're taking place as part of a legitimate social, a political movement to change a government and society, revolutions engender all kinds of terrible things that go on, even if the revolution is being motivated by a good cause. It may not be motivated by a good cause, but so there's all these gray issues and gray lines that everybody has to deal with. In dealing with these kinds of crises.
Well, and we've just talked about, in response to George's call, and George, thank you very much, when you start this doctrine of responsibility to protect, he also raised the important point, I think, Michael, of when you stop, for example, NATO's gone, Gaddafi's gone, but there's some bad stuff still happening in Libya. I mean, just random groups randomly killing people. So when does R2P stop?
I can't answer that. You know, I mean, that's above my pay grade. I mean, obviously the governments involved in these interventions have to determine when they need to step aside and let the locals sort things out. And arguably, they made the decision to step back in Libya prematurely.
I would add to Mike's comment. I think they end either when the international community loses interest, and we do have a short attention span often. Or they wind down because the society is starting to move in some better direction. Now, the other problem in terms of subjectivity here is we know lots of terrible things are occurring in Libya, But I don't know that I, as an American, could stand back and look down my nose at that and cast aspersions on that if, in the end, it produces a democratic society. Societies going through revolutions do terrible things to each other to produce that kind of outcome.
Let's take another call. This is Polna in Concord. Hi, Polna. Thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
My question is, the international community intervened pretty fast in Libya, but really doesn't do anything in Syria. And I wonder if it might have to do with the oil supply, because the Libya has one of the largest supplies of oil in the Africa, and Syria almost has no oil. And I wonder if that's what might be the strategic interest that's preventing U.S. from stepping in. And other countries as well.
Polna, thanks a lot for the call. What do you think, Michael?
It's not the United States that hasn't wanted to step in Syria. The United States, France, and Britain very much in the Security Council did want to step in Syria and have been putting a lot of pressure on the Chinese and the Russians to act in Syria. It's the Russians and the Chinese that have been dragging their feet there. That there are interests there is very clear, but I don't think we can fault the United States in this case of not wanting to intervene. I would just come back to something that Bill said before about intervening in Syria. Also, this would if intervention takes place, I don't know if it's going to, but if it does, it's going to be a lot more difficult and a lot messier than in Libya. Syria is a very different kind of country, and the logistics of trying to intervene there will be much more difficult and much more costly.
And if there is intervention in Syria, my strong prediction is that it won't be American, UN, or other forces. It'll be providing weapons to the rebels, the opposition forces, to help them tear apart the government military, which is otherwise a very imbalanced, military. The military imbalance is overwhelming in favor of the government of Syria. That's likely the scenario that we'll see.
Yeah, and there will be attempt to tip the balance so that there'll be more defections from government forces towards the opposition.
Yes,
well,
indeed.
And that's, again, under this doctrine that we're talking about, responsibility to protect, Bill. You know, when you hear it, it sounds like, okay, UN people or NATO people are going to come in and protect, women and children from whatever violence happens to be happening. Responsibility to protect doesn't sound like arming rebels.
No. It can very clearly involve that.
Because that's really choosing sides and making a judgment call. It's gone beyond, let's protect these poor folks. They don't deserve to be, shot dead in the midst of a civil war. But going in and arming the other side is
it's a wholly different thing. It's that we're not in Kansas anymore, Toto.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a whole different scenario. But if your objective is to prevent genocide, humanitarian abuses, and you see a government that's doing that, and the international community, again, there's a slight degree of uncomfort in my voice because sovereignty, everybody knows that every state has legal independent authority and autonomy. But when all that happens, then the question we have to ask is, do we not provide that assistance if we find military forces by the government opposing this? Syria, does the international community allow the Syrian government to continue to do this? I'm uncomfortable taking that leap. On the other hand, we could argue geostrategically that the erosion of the government of Syria would have tremendous positive implications for that part of the world, but that's a whole separate subjective argument that George raised just 10 minutes ago.
Well, we might need to talk about that on a future program, the effect of this unrest and turmoil in Syria on that region for sure. But go ahead, Michael.
I'd like to address the issue of sovereignty and what sovereignty means. Historically, sovereignty has essentially meant power. It's meant that within a nation's borders, the government has a monopoly on the legitimate use of force. And the World Outcome document, which was endorsed by the General Assembly in 2005, I think fundamentally questions that. So the governments of the world have essentially said, no, sovereignty isn't just power. Sovereignty is responsibility. That sovereignty is something that governments earn by protecting their citizens from atrocity crimes. And if they fail to do that, it is the responsibility of the international community to help them do it better. And if they still cannot do it, then it is a responsibility of the international community to take responsibility for preventing these atrocity crimes.
So I think
we have seen with R2P, we have seen a fundamental reassessment of what national sovereignty means. That's why it's such a potentially important long-term term normative change for the international community.
Well, and that's why it's such a huge departure from standard thought, as Bill said
from
at the beginning. And this sounds real good, Michael, but what if a couple countries said, you know, in the United States, things aren't going so well, and, you know, they've got the death penalty in the United States, and a lot of European countries think that's wrong, and we have a responsibility to protect those people on death row.
Well, the R2P principle does not apply to the death penalty. It doesn't apply. It applies very specifically to genocide, war crimes, crimes against humanity, and ethnic cleansing.
So it's not broadly applied willy-nilly to anything that upsets you. There's some specifics there.
It is, well, it only refers to these big atrocity crimes. And also, and I think it's important to remember this, it assigns primary responsibility to the governments themselves to deal with it. I would just say one last thing. I hear the music coming on, that the United States has a veto on the Security Council, which is the instrument that would have to impose a sanction. So I don't think we need to worry about this coming home that quickly.
All right. Well, both of you, this has been real interesting. Michael Contarino, thank you so much for being
here.
Really appreciate it. Michael Contarino, Politics and Society Program Director at UNH Manchester. He's also published several articles about responsibility to protect. Bill Martell, it's always good to see you. Thank you for being here.
It's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Bill Martell, Associate Professor of International Security Studies at Tufts University's Fletcher School and author of the book Victory in War, Foundations of Modern Strategy. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our intern is Ryan Lessard. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. The Exchange's executive producer is Keith Shields. I'm Laura Kanoy.